Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three causes on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Jaffe Aircraft or Jaffe Industries Incorporated versus Mary Carr, individually and as representative of the state of Nathan Henry Carr, Henry and Mary Ann Johnson Carr, from Bexar County. Canadian Helicopters Limited versus the Honorable Don E. Whitty, with an original mandamus proceeding. And State Bar of Texas versus Lloyd E. Humphreys, a disciplinary appeal. In the first two causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral arguments, and the final matter, 15 minutes for each side. The petitioner, relator, or appellant may reserve a portion of time for a rebuttal argument by so advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of these arguments. We will conclude the arguments before lunch. These arguments are being recorded for the court's convenience. If you desire to listen to a tape of the argument, you may make application with the clerk of our court. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Jaffe Aircraft versus Carr.
May it please the court, Ms. Deborah Hankinson will present argument to petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This case is before the court because the Court of Appeals has failed to apply the proper legal standards in reviewing a factual sufficiency challenge to a jury verdict. The result of the court's failure to do so has resulted in a substitution of the Court of Appeals judgment for that of the jury. This was done in the face of a case that was hotly contested with conflicting testimony, contradictory testimony by the plaintiff's main witness, and a case that was based primarily on hearsay presented by the plaintiff that called upon the jury to exercise its function in determining the credibility of the witnesses and what it chose to believe. All of this was presented in the face of the jury being asked to answer the question, what caused the wing to fall off an airplane, an experimental plane that was on a routine flight in clear weather when it was uncontested that the pilot at that time was not flying the plane in a negligent manner?
Did the single jury question inquire about the negligence of the pilot, Mr. Mulburn?
It was phrased in terms of the pilot's employer and whether or not the pilot's employer, at that time Jaffe Industries, now Jaffe Aircraft, was negligent and whether that negligence approximately caused the accident in question. The plaintiffs based their theory on allegations that the plaintiff had exceeded the limitations of the plane in previous flights and had therefore stressed the wing to the point that it failed during the flight.
And was it uncontested that at the time that, just prior to the crash occurring, there were no aerobatics going on and this plane was proceeding within its operational limits as far as speed and was going in a straight flight path?
That's correct, Your Honor. And that was uncontested at the trial. So we were looking at a situation where the jury was faced with a difficult situation. Both the pilot and the passenger died in the crash. And the result was the jury, in hindsight, looking back at a difficult factual question in trying to decide what had happened. The plane was a prototype of a military trainer. It was an experimental plane. The pilot, Mr. Mulburn, was a test pilot. He had taken the plane to Wright Air Force Base in Ohio. Captain Carr, the plaintiff's decedent, was flying in the plane with him as part of the demonstration flights that were being done for the Air Force. The trainer was being jointly developed by Mr. Mulberg's employer, Jaffe, and Ed Swearingen, who was the designer and manufacturer of the prototype, pursuant to a research and development contract. Mr. Swearingen originally was a defendant in the lawsuit. He got out of the lawsuit on summary judgment that was unopposed by the plaintiff and became the plaintiff's main witness at trial. The jury answered no to the liability question after a 7-day trial. On appeal, the Court of Appeals rejected the plaintiff's challenge to the legal sufficiency of the evidence, but instead it held that the jury's failure to find negligence and its failure to find proximate cause were against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence. Because the majority opinion, there was a dissent, did not fully recite the evidence that was in the record and did not and could not, because it had not recited all the evidence, explain why the supporting evidence was insufficient, the majority did not properly apply the legal standards that this court has mandated. This, therefore, is a case where the challenge is to a non-finding of liability. The complaining party on appeal had the burden of proof on the issue. Therefore, the appropriate test is whether the jury finding was so against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence as to be manifestly unjust. This court has looked repeatedly at the issue of how the Court of Appeals' constitutional authority to review factual sufficiency is to be squared with the constitutional inviolate right to a trial by jury. In doing that, the court has carefully set out standards in terms of how the Court of Appeals is to review the evidentiary record to be certain that it does not do what has in fact happened in this case, and that is to substitute its judgment for that of the jury when it decides that, had it been the jury, it might have decided the case differently. As a result, based on the decisions of this case and this court in such cases as Poole and Proper, the Court of Appeals was required to detail all the elements, evidence relevant to the issue, the liability issue in this case. That means both sides of the evidence. It must then state why the evidence is so against the great weight as to be manifestly unjust, and state in what regard the contrary evidence greatly outweighs the evidence in support of the verdict. How did the Court of Appeals err in this case? Based on the Carr's theory, they were required to prove two facts: that Mr. Malberg operated the plane outside its design limitations to the extent that his conduct constituted negligence. And that was the conduct not at the date, on the date of the flight where the accident happened, but on previous occasions. And second, that this negligence proximately caused the accident. The majority was obligated to detail all the evidence supporting a non-finding on each of the issues and give an explanation as to why that was not sufficient. But a review of the majority opinion shows very clearly that the majority only recited the evidence that was contrary to the jury's findings. In reviewing that opinion, I can only find one reference to evidence that supported the jury finding. There was evidence in the trial from Mr. Jaffe that Mr. Swearingen had said that there was a pre-existing crack, or possibly a pre-existing crack in the wing, that had occurred at some time earlier, perhaps during the original testing of the prototype when Mr. Swearingen owned the plane, or during manufacturing, and that was one possible cause. That is the only indication that I find of any effort of the Court of Appeals to look at any other evidence. And yet the Court of Appeals criticized the credibility of that proof by saying it was hearsay. I find that comment particularly interesting in light of the fact that most of the plaintiff's evidence was hearsay, alleged hearsay, of the dead pilot. And in fact, the Court of Appeals opinion reflects that. The plaintiffs tried their case based heavily on the reports of several witnesses who said that Mr. Malberg had told them that he had pushed the plane beyond its limits, that he was doing aerobatics in the plane, and that Mr. Swearingen had been informed of that, and he had told Mr. Malberg to stop. Hearsay of the dead pilot, who was not at trial, in order to offer an explanation as to whether he said those things, if he said them, why he said them, what he meant about them. So while the Court of Appeals criticized the one piece of evidence that it cited in support of the verdict, it failed to comment upon the hearsay evidence that the plaintiffs had offered and relied primarily upon. The Court of Appeals also reached conclusions about the record that are based on an inaccurate review. And looking at the question of proximate cause, The court states that every expert or every pilot who testified stated that the cause of the accident was the fact that Malbert had exceeded the limitations of the plane on previous occasions. But looking at the record, that's not what the testimony was. In fact, the plaintiff's attorney, Pat Maloney, was asking questions of the pilots that were hypothetical. Assume that he exceeded the limitations. Could that have caused the plane to crash? A review of the actual record shows that, in fact, many of those people refused to believe that Mr. Malbert would do that. Because he was an exemplary pilot, there was no direct evidence that he had ever abused this plane or any other plane during his 20-year career in the military or after that. So as a result, the Court of Appeals has also based its review on conclusions from the record rather than detailing the evidence, which is outside its jurisdiction. Finally, another error that the Court of Appeals committed was that it improperly transferred the burden of proof to the defendant to prove an alternative cause of the accident. It looked to the record and said, we can find no other cause. Bad weather, pilot error during the flight where the accident occurred, nothing else that tells us that there could be another cause. Therefore, since we can't find another cause in the record, it must be like the plaintiff's death. The defendant had no burden to prove that there was an alternative cause. It was the plaintiff's burden of proof to convince the jury by a preponderance of the evidence that Mr. Malbert's conduct had caused the crash. The jury found that they failed to do so. The application for writ of error that we have submitted on behalf of the petitioners details specifically with record cite all the evidence that supports the jury's verdict. It has been done so that this court can be aware and can see how the Court of Appeals failed to meet its burden to detail all the evidence. We have reviewed the evidence relating to the non-finding of negligence. There is evidence to support three different theories. The cars may have failed to establish what the plane's limitations actually were. There was confusing and conflicting testimony on that. There was confusing and conflicting testimony about that even if the plane's limitations had been established, the jury was entitled to disbelieve the sole evidence that Malbert exceeded the limitations, hearsay, and instead believe eyewitness testimony that he had never abused the plane and his assurances to Mr. Swearingen that he had never done so. Furthermore, the non-finding of negligence could have been based on the fact that even if the limitations were exceeded, that the record supports the conclusion that Malbert was a test pilot testing an experimental plane under the supervision of Mr. Swearingen, the designer and manufacturer, and that in doing that, exceeding the limitations was part of what a test pilot does. And in doing that, he would not be negligent under the circumstances. There is further conflicting evidence on the question of proximate cause. Mr. Swearingen was the main witness on that, and his testimony changed. At his deposition, he talked about a pre-existing crash. At trial, after he was out of the case, he suddenly talked about Mr. Malbert's alleged abuse of the plane. There was further conflicting testimony on even if Mr. Malbert had on several occasions exceeded the limitations of the plane, did he do so often enough to, in fact, have stressed the plane to the point that there could be structural damage? That was hotly debated at trial. The proof was very weak. No one could say that if this had happened, had it happened more than once or twice, three or four times. Mr. Swearingen testified that you would have to do aerobics and exceed the aerobatic and exceed the red line on this plane every day, all day, over and over again in order to cause the wing to fall off. There was no testimony that that happened. The plaintiffs pinned a lot of stake on the fact that the red line indicator had been changed on the plane. The red line is the limitation on the speed indicator that shows what the limit of the plane is in terms of flying speed. The testimony at trial was that that had been changed for cosmetic reasons to show the Air Force that when the prototype for the military trainer that was being developed off this prototype was actually in production, that's what it would look like, that it was a cosmetic change. Merely changing the indicator doesn't mean that you can fly the plane that fast. The plane has a limit how fast it can fly.
Ms. Hankinson, the Court of Appeals reviewed this non-finding on a sort of an against the preponderance and great weight of the evidence. But the defendant didn't have the burden on this. For the Court of Appeals to come to the conclusion that it did, wouldn't it, as a matter of fact, have to say the jury could not have found no to this question? In other words, the plaintiffs had to have established their claim as a matter of law?
I think that that's ultimately what the court is saying, that we don't agree that on this record the jury could find except
fact, they have to say the jury had to have found yes based on this
yes.
record.
Yes, I think that's what the court would feel.
So when you're talking about a non-finding, isn't that really isn't the Court of Appeals really required to conclude that there is no way the jury could have found otherwise? And that's just as a matter of law.
I think that's the impact of this opinion, although that's not what the Court of Appeals has said, but I agree with you. And that's, I think, why perhaps this court in past years in the Proper case struggled a little bit with whether or not you would look at against the great weight of the preponderance in a non-finding situation, since the defendant or the non-complaining party does not have the burden. Ultimately, that's the result of this review.
If the Court of Appeals was instructed that you do an as a matter of law review, that's really what would be the appropriate review for cases like this in a non-finding. The plaintiff says they just can't not find this. Isn't that the standard that we're looking at? Does the evidence establish as a matter of law that the plaintiff should have won?
I agree with that, and is it? Yes, I do. The Court of Appeals, of course, said that standard was not met, that this was not as a matter of law, and yet that's the impact of it.
But then they couldn't reverse the judgment, could they?
Agreed. The result of the review of the detailed evidence in the record as reflected in brief shows that the Court of Appeals has, in fact, invaded the jury's area under the Constitution, and we ask this Court to reverse the Court of Appeals' decision on that basis.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counsel. The Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Mr. Charles Nicholson will present argument for respondents.
May it please the Court. I don't know of any attorney who's tried cases to a jury who really feels comfortable about taking or asking the court to take a verdict from the jury. It's really not the function of my argument today to re-argue the facts and to show why the evidence preponderates one way or the other, why it's manifestly unjust. Because the function of this court, of course, is to find that if the Court of Appeals did not follow the requirements of Poole, of Alm, of Crawford, and detail the evidence in its opinion, which overruled the jury verdict, then this court has to remand for reconsideration of that evidence. I'd like to address myself, if I could, to the question asked by Justice Enix as to the appropriate standard. In the Crawford case, and my office is painfully aware of this because we had a jury verdict taken away from us in the Crawford case, we argued for the very standard that Justice Enix that you proposed, that it has to be as a matter of law, the jury finding is not supported by the evidence. And if it's not as a matter of law, then the jury verdict should not be taken away.
Now,
are you talking
about an affirmative finding by jury as opposed to a non-finding by jury?
No. In that case, Your Honor, there was a failure of the jury to find contributory negligence, a failure on a defensive issue in which the defense had an affirmative judgment. And we said, you can't take that away, that there's no right to take that away. And we argued basically what you're arguing, Your Honor, that as a matter of law, you can't take this judgment from us. But in the Crawford case, this court said that in reviewing non-findings, the Court of Appeals had the same scope and authority and applied the same ruling, the same law as it did for a jury's findings. In other words, it treated findings and non-findings identically, and it rejected our argument. In this case, I would disagree with counsel that the evidence that we rely on heavily is hearsay. We relied upon the statements of a party, of a representative of a party, Mr. Mulberg. And there's no question in this case that Mulberg was the representative of the defendant, Jaffee, in this case. There was not even an issue, and it was simply conceded by all the parties. We argued that point in the Court of Appeals to make clear that the statements of Mulberg were binding on Jaffee because he was a party, and there was never even a response to that in the Court of Appeals, and that's not really argued by either party. Here, I think it's conceded. What Mulberg says is not hearsay under Rule 801, and I believe the specific citation is E2, where the statements of a party or the representatives of a party is not hearsay. That can contrast to the statements relied upon by the petitioners, where they're saying that the Court of Appeals failed to give due consideration to the testimony of Mr. Jaffee, who at one time was a defendant in this case and was dismissed on the directed verdict close of the proof, that he had been told by Mr. Dees and by Mr. Swearingen on the day of the accident that night that they didn't know why the wings had fallen off this plane. That's clearly hearsay. Neither Mr. Swearingen nor Mr. Dees are parties to the case. The Court of Appeals appropriately pointed that out, that we had testimony by the only two experts to testify in the case, Mr. Swearingen and Mr. Jones, that the cause of this plane crash was the overstressing of the wings by the pilot. We had testimony by a friend of Mulberg, the pilot, that he told him that if he was going to continue to fly the plane that he was flying in the manner that he was flying it, he was going to have a wreck.
Was there contradictory evidence? Was evidence to the contrary?
Well, the evidence to the contrary would be Mr. Jaffee's testimony that on the night of the accident, Mr. Swearingen or Mr. Dees, and it's unclear whether both of them were present or whether Mr. Swearingen, clearly Mr. Swearingen was, said that it could have been a crash that occurred early on in the process, maybe in the manufacturing process. There's clearly that testimony. Now, and that's just testimony that the Court of Appeals did consider. The other testimony, and I will concede that the Court of Appeals does not reference in its opinion, is the testimony that Mr. Mulberg was an excellent pilot, that several of the people who had flown with him had never seen him exceed the capabilities of a plane. And there's testimony that that Mr. Swearingen had flown with him in the plane. There's testimony that Mr. Mulberg's wife has flown with him in the plane. And to the extent that that testimony, Your Honor, could be considered as contrary evidence, or there could be implications from that as contrary evidence, that would be evidence that was not specifically detailed in the Court of Appeals' opinion.
And then you can say that the Court of Appeals committed error?
Well, I don't know that if you can say it committed error. The way that I read the Poole case is not only does the court need to, well, let me, if I can read the quote from the Poole case, from the Cropper case, I think it would put maybe the scope of this court's a review into context. In his motion for rehearing, and this is the motion for rehearing in the Court of Appeals, and I'm reading from page 653 of the Cropper opinion, which is 754 Southwest 2nd. In his motion for rehearing, Cropper brought to the attention of the Court of Appeals certain testimony and evidence that was not referred to by the court in its opinion and which somewhat contradicted the version of facts recited by the court in its opinion. And when I read that, it looks like the court really needs to look at all evidence that potentially could support the Court of Appeals or jury verdict and to cite that in its opinion. But then the court also continues on. Further, the evidence specifically referred to in Cropper's motion lends substantial support to the jury's verdict. And so I think what the Cropper case is saying is the court clearly needs to detail all evidence that would support the jury verdict. If it is substantial support, there may be some sort of trivial evidence that the court wouldn't necessarily have to recite in its opinion. Otherwise, it would just attach the transcript of the trial or the statement of facts as an appendix. But I think if it is substantial evidence, and if this court finds that the evidence of the testimony that Mr. Mulberg was an excellent pilot to be substantial evidence, then I think the court would have to remand this to the Court of Appeals and direct the Court of Appeals to consider that evidence.
Is that what the opposing counsel is asking?
Well, I think it's exactly what it's asking. And, but then the court...
Did you join her in that request?
No, I don't believe that evidence is substantial. I don't believe that that's substantial testimony. The fact that people admit that he's a very capable pilot that he was a very good pilot, that that testimony by Mr. Swearingen that he was an excellent pilot, necessarily leads to the conclusion that he did or did not abuse the plane. I don't know that there's any particular inference or presumption that can be drawn from that that the court or the jury would be required to find. I would see that evidence as more as of an ambiguous type of testimony or evidence that doesn't necessarily lead substantial support to either way, to either position of either party. There's testimony that Mr. Swearingen himself is an excellent designer of the airplane. He's the designer and manufacturer of the airplane. And Mr. Jaffe testified that he is the most competent person to give opinions to why the plane crashed. And it would be that similar type of evidence that it's the bolstering, maybe the testimony or bolstering the credibility of a party or of a witness. So I wouldn't think that either the testimony that Mr. Swearingen is the most competent person to give an opinion, or the testimony that Mr. Moberg was an excellent pilot, necessarily would require the jury to find one way or another. I think that if the court finds that the testimony that was set forth in the brief of petitioners, that Mr. Moberg was an excellent pilot.
Is that all? Is that all that was omitted from the Court of Appeals?
No, Your Honor. There's also some testimony that about a National Pilots magazine reported that the airplane was stressed for plus 9 or negative Gs. So there was testimony about that.
That's the testimony set forth in the dissent.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The testimony set forth in the dissenting opinion. What about that? Is that too omitted from the court?
Well, what the dissenting opinion sets forth is the fact that Mr. Moberg was an excellent pilot. And in the dissenting opinion by Judge Peoples criticizes the majority for not considering that testimony.
He refers to some other testimony.
Let me see, Your Honor. I know that there's one other aspect of the testimony that Justice Peoples referred to. That's the one that comes to mind. He also referred to the, you're right, Your Honor, that Mr. Swearingen had been told by Mr. Moberg that he had not exceeded the red line. The significance of that is that Mr. Swearingen had designed the plane for specific speed capabilities, and there was testimony that capabilities of the plane had been exceeded by Mr. Moberg by over 100 miles per hour.
But and then there's also testimony that he didn't.
That's
not in the Court of Appeals opinion. Would that be material?
I would think that would be significant testimony, Your Honor, that it's a statement of a party, Mr. Moberg.
So then you do concede it has to go back.
Well, I hate to put myself in that position, Judge, but I would have
that
to say
that. That seems inescapable.
Yeah. But...
Is that right, or...?
If that testimony, Your Honor, was substantial testimony, I think that under any test of this court, you would have to send the case back for, with the direction of the Court of Appeals, to consider that specific testimony.
Do you think it was substantial?
I will have to concede that in this court, I would consider it to be substantial testimony. In the Court of Appeals, in light of the fact that there were only two experts who testified, I think that the argument would be that would not be substantial or sufficient enough to sustain the jury verdict, but that it's something that the Court of Appeals should consider. I would have to concede that. And I would also concede that, having conceded that, Judge, I don't think there would be a lot more purpose for me to take up the court's time in any further argument. Thank you.
No questions. Thank you.
I had intended to point out to the court on rebuttal. that I thought that what Mr. Nicholson was doing was pointing to the fact that there were legitimate jury questions presented by the record, and that those questions needed to remain in the hands of the jury in order to decide, for the jury to decide what to believe and what not to believe, and what was substantial and what was not in terms of its decision. However, I would like to point out one other thing in response to Justice Enoch's earlier question. In the brief submitted by a respondent, they characterized the issue presented by the Court of Appeals as this. That court correctly focused on the issue at the heart of this case. Does the great weight and preponderance of the evidence establish that a proximate cause of this occurrence was the negligence of the pilot Forrest Marlborough? The Court of Appeals properly found that it did. That is the respondent's characterization of what the Court of Appeals did. And perhaps, as Justice Enoch has pointed out, this is a case which shows the problem with the Court of Appeals reviewing non-findings for the great weight and preponderance of the evidence test when we are looking at that in the face of an issue that the non-complaining party does not have the burden on. And when this case is, if and when it is sent back to the Court of Appeals, direction to Court of Appeals looking at that issue would perhaps be helpful and instructive to avoid this kind of invasion of the jury's domain in the future.
You're asking, though, basically that we just apply Poole and Lofton against Texas Bryant and these other cases in the same way when the defendant loses, as we do if the plaintiff loses. Has happened in those cases.
I'm sorry, would you repeat your question, Your Honor?
In Lofton and I think in Poole, there were remands to the Court of Appeals because the Court of Appeals overturned a jury verdict and the plaintiff was adversely affected. And we set a standard there.
Right.
You're, as I understand it from your briefs, arguing that it applies both ways.
And I believe that's been this court's position. I think that's the position adopted by this court in Cropper. I think that this particular situation, however, points out the problem when you're dealing with a non-finding situation and applying the test to that in the Court of Appeals. And I'm just agreeing with, I believe, Justice Enoch, that this is an appropriate time for the court to relook at that question. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes argument in the first case. The fourth case.